There's no particular reason why a college softball team should become an NCAA powerhouse, but in more than three decades, Coach Carol Hutchins has built an empire. She's the winningest coach in Michigan history, across sports, men and women's, with more than 1,500 victories. But she'd like some company. She wrote a recent op-ed for the New York Times noting that few coaches in women's sports are, in fact, women. Which wouldn't be so strange, except that women coaches are extremely rare among men's sports. Coach Hutchins, welcome to Stateside.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Your op-ed in the New York Times noted that of all coaches for all women's sports, the 42% are women, which is astonishing. But I was even more flabbergasted to read what you said about how before Title IX, there were far, far more women coaching, 90%. What happened?
Well, I think you can look at the fact that back in the late 60s and throughout the 70s, you can look at college athletics, you can look at high school athletics. Women played largely on club teams, while young men had varsity teams. They had junior varsity teams at all levels. There wasn't a lot of organized sport for women.
It was a labor of love.
It was definitely a labor of love. But there were certainly a number of young women, myself being one of them. And back in the 60s, we were called tomboys. You know, we like to do what boys like to do. And most of us were told, well, that's, you know, girls don't play sports. Boys play sports. Girls cheerlead. And we were also told, that in general, girls aren't interested, which wasn't true because I knew a lot of girls that were interested. But it was hard to be interested in something that didn't exist. And I talk about my story a lot because my evolution as a person, I was born in the late 50s, Title IX passed when I was a sophomore in high school. I just kind of evolved with Title IX my whole career. And I did not play a varsity sport in high school until my senior year when the MHSAA finally added girls basketball as a state-sanctioned sport, and we had a state tournament. We had actually a real schedule. We had real uniforms. We had a bus that took us, and we even had cheerleaders. Before that, we had played basically, they called it GAA, Girls Athletic Activities, or just basically club basketball. We'd play four or five games a year, and our gym teachers would take us on, and those who had interest in different sports would coach us. So I played a few of those sports in high school, but it wasn't until my senior year I really had a varsity status. And the same was true in college. And so largely, even though those few opportunities, you would see women as the coaches, women who had an interest in sport, women who had had their own active time in their day. And my varsity coach in college, Karen Langland, was a full-time instructor in the School of Physical Education, as she had full-time teaching duties, and she was a part-time basketball coach for probably, if I'm not mistaken, $6,000 a year. And Judd Heathcote was the basketball coach at Michigan State, and he was, of course, a full-time coach paid probably six figures back in that day, and Karen was just considered part-time. And it was like throw a few crumbs out to the women, and they would get to play. So you can look at there were fewer opportunities out there to coach, but they were largely filled with women who were interested in women having opportunities to play and recognize the value and the educational aspect of being an athlete.
After Title IX, though, there were many more salaried positions coaching women's varsity sports. It appears that a lot more men got interested in the jobs.
Well, you can say that, and it took a while. It didn't happen. Title IX passed in 72, and it was all the way through the 80s, really. I would like to see the numbers at that point of how many women coached, and there were certainly men involved. There were men in coaching, and my first college basketball coach my freshman year was a male, but this is the interesting statistic. He had come over from the men's team. He had been the men's manager, the equipment manager of the men's basketball team for Gus Kanakis and then Judd Heathcote, and they'd made him into the women's basketball coach. So that will tell you a little bit how those things came down.
So it sounds like this is a confluence of opportunities being available and a lack of a development path for women's coaches.
Well, and
coaches
a lot of people would argue where there weren't a lot of women who had a ton of varsity experience, you know. But But as it goes, back then, women were the ones who wanted to see this move forward. They wanted to see athletics progress. But as Title IX increased the opportunity for women, it mandated across the board that if you're a federally funded institution, which is the majority of colleges, not all, and of course high schools, you had to give the women the same opportunity in all aspects of education, not just sport, but all aspects of education, the same opportunity as the men got. And it really became glaring where the biggest inequity was, which was in sport. And so we started adding more teams, creating varsity opportunities for the women. And along the way, in the college level, the NCAA decided to sponsor women's sports, and that was in 1982. And when they started sponsoring the championships, you saw a huge spike in opportunities given and salaries for coaches and so forth. So the women athletes, you know, started getting a lot more of the opportunity. But as it became a really full-blown profession, you certainly just saw, which I think was normal. I don't think this is a case where you would ostracize men for being interested in coaching, because coaching is coaching. And I've listened to many a male coach talk about how much they love coaching women, how they're kind of a different animal to coach. But the fact is that the issue here is who's being chosen to lead, period, to lead in athletic and the leadership positions. And coaching is certainly a leadership position.
What does the career path look like right now for women players who want to be coaching?
Well, obviously, first and foremost, we look at young women who have come through the trenches of playing competitively. And it depends on what level they're aspiring to. But if they're an education major and aspire to be a high school teacher and a coach, obviously, they go into that route. The college path is basically you come up through the ranks of being a competitive player, and you would hire in. We usually start at what we call the volunteer status in softball. We have what's called the volunteer coach, and it's a glorified position where you can come in, work for free, and get experience. And you see men and women take that path and then hopefully aspire into paid positions. One of the issues that goes hand in hand in this is certainly when a woman plays competitive college softball and she is out in the job market and she is compared with all the other candidates in the market, we see a lot of programs who end up taking young men who, face it, young men never played college softball because it's not a college sport. They may have played baseball. They may be good at what they do. But my concern is that if you look across the landscape, and if you look at just college, I mean, you could certainly look at high school and look at travel ball, and those have different issues. But if you look across the landscape of college athletics, the presence of male coaches on the benches of all women's teams, especially in Division I and especially in Power Five, there's a presence. Almost all benches have, whether it's male assistant, whether it's a couple male assistants, whether it's male head coaches, the presence of men coaching women is huge. Is there anything wrong with that? No. But if you look across the exact same men's sports, across Division I, across the Power Five, there's virtually no women of presence on any benches of any male sports in the NCAA.
So what's on your mind about this? Something maybe like the Rooney Rule, which in the NFL requires teams to interview people of color when they have a coaching vacancy?
That's certainly been spoken of in our profession, in the think tanks out there. To me, the first thing, and part of the reason for my involvement in the op-ed for the New York Times is really public awareness of it. One of the things that we talked about during the interview that wasn't in the interview was, you know, we're very committed to diversity and inclusion across colleges across the country. And most college presidents would not probably be too keen on having only 25% of their entire faculty be women. If there's only 42% of women coaching women's sports and virtually 100% of men coaching male sports, you see we're really barely at 25% of the total leadership population. And it's an opportunity to lead, to have role models, and for women to have the same opportunities as men.
There was an article a couple of years ago in Champion Magazine, which is an NCAA publication. I know you're aware of it because you were quoted in it pretty extensively. And the article noted that sometimes coaching has not been a kind profession for working mothers, for gay women, and others who may have faced discrimination in hiring. How do you think people in power positions can be held to some kind of transparency about hiring decisions that might be discriminatory?
I think one of the most fascinating things I have been studying this last year is the implicit gender bias that is still alive and well, definitely in college athletics, definitely in society. I'm certainly not here to talk politics, but if you look at how the female candidates are judged, there's certainly a bias that women are held to different standards. And I think women are held to different standards in our profession, for sure. And whether it comes to the hiring practices, definitely women have different issues than men because we are largely the caregivers of our families. You know, you have women who want to create families and they have to have maternity leave. And those are things that, you know, in a hiring practice cannot be held against you. But are they? I'm certain that they could be. But I think that the bigger issue is, you know, who is making the hiring decisions? And if, again, across the landscape, I don't know the exact percentages, but male athletic directors dominate the landscape. There are very few women athletic directors. And in the Power Five, I believe there's only five.
I want to say the national percentage is only 18% female.
And that would include all the levels. So in the Division I and Power Five, it's very low percentage. And again, they say people tend to hire people who are like them. And, you know, men have their own network. But I don't think it's largely on just the men to take a look and say, gee, we need to include more women. Men don't seem to be offended by the fact that women don't have a seat at the table. I do believe if they were the population that didn't have a seat at the table, they would look at it through the same lens that perhaps I look at it through. But I think it starts with people like myself who have been fortunate to have this longstanding leadership position at a university that is one of the leaders and the best. And it's on people like myself to speak out, to ensure that I give women an opportunity as I want to see my young women who play under me, young women who I play against, have that opportunity to go out and get a chance to do what I've done my whole life. And it's really about opportunity and opportunity for leadership positions.
You talk in your op-ed about the double standard for women coaches, and you say that we all know what the trope is. When a woman doesn't lead well or gets dismissed, it's evidence that a woman can't lead. But if a man doesn't work out, it's not the right fit. How have you seen this play out, either in your own career or other coaches that you know?
I think a couple things. But I have a number of friends who have, whether they've been investigated, whether they've been let go from their careers, and I mean a number of close friends in my inner circle who are good people, good coaches, but things get twisted often. And sometimes it's a case of women tend to have to be in their various athletic departments. They have to fight for whether it's practice time, the same resources, salaries. And those coaches aren't always well received by their athletic directors. And then somebody may complain that, gee, you know, they got disciplined, and so they view it as abuse. They don't like how their coach does things because it's not warm and fuzzy. And if you look at how male coaches coach, I don't think it's always warm and fuzzy. There's definitely moments that it needs to be warm and fuzzy. And there's no question your kids need to know you care about them. And you're here to help them grow up. You're like their second parent. I mean, I think abuse is something that you would certainly, I'm not here to condone it. I want to certainly state that. But it's really a case of, are you just being pushed to a level that you don't like and it doesn't feel good? Because it doesn't always feel good to have to push farther than you're used to. And I think that there's a lot of gender bias involved where women are held to a different standard than the men because you don't see nearly the cases of abuse against male coaches. But a lot of those things get twisted around and you've seen a lot of women go through allegations of abuse when in reality they're just coaching and they're coaching exactly like their male counterparts. They're just viewed differently. They're held to different standards. And sometimes it's as simple as the AD doesn't like that they're questioning their practices because there's so many cases where Title IX has improved things so much, but there's still a lot of cases where things are not equal.
What happens to women coaches who lose their jobs?
When a woman coach is fired, I have seen very, very few women resurface in the coaching profession. Not never, but at an alarming rate. I've seen a Hall of Fame softball coach who had over 900 career wins who lost her job and couldn't even get a job interview elsewhere. It's really common that when a woman is fired, no AD wants to touch them. They can have a fantastic reputation in the coaching circles, but ADs don't want to deal with that. But yet you can look across the landscape of male college athletics. We look at a basketball coach who was caught drinking with college co-eds at fraternity parties, and he's still in the coaching profession after he was let go. You can go on and on. Men, it's just not the right fit, or, you know, it's part of our profession, and it is part of our profession. Sometimes it's not the right fit, or things, you know, spiral down for a coach. But I can tell you that men do a really great job of championing men, and we don't do nearly the same job of championing women and recognizing that it is part of our profession, but it doesn't make you a bad coach or a bad person. It just means it didn't work out. But we don't see women get the same second chance as men.
Who showed you the way?
Well, I think all the women who came before me. I mean, I grew up in a time when, you know, my female role models were people like Margie Wright and Linda Wells, who had coached at Minnesota for many years. Of course, Gail Blevins, who ended up being my mentor. And, you know, they coached a little bit ahead of me in a time when there was very, very little support. But they were out to create an opportunity and environment for women that was equal to what the men have, which is equal opportunity and chances to compete, competitively and explore that aspect of themselves where they could play on the field and be great and become really successful women. And they every day they walked out there with not nearly the support that I've ended up having over my career. And they're the ones who paved the way for people like myself. And, you know, we continue to hopefully pay it forward.
Where would you like to see the goalposts these days for the program and also for the players who, you know, right now may look at their options to play pro fast pitch and not see a lot out there?
Well, there's no question. We have a pro league. It's been fledgling, to tell you the truth, over the years. What they need is they need a big-time sponsor. You know, the WNBA has made it pretty well. They've had the help of the NBA.
I understand women's soccer is looking right now as well.
Absolutely. And I always say this, you know, I've been doing this now. I'm moving into my, getting close to my fifth decade, I suppose. It's an evolution. I'm pretty sure that the first year of Michigan football, they didn't have 110,000 people at their games. And I'm pretty sure that in the first era of all these sports, I mean, we first started out, and I came into the program in, year 7. We had barely had a field. We had a few of the parents that came to the games and the sports info people, and that was about it. And now we regularly sell 2,500 tickets, and we would sell many more, but we don't have any more places for people to sit. It's evolved into that, and I believe that these opportunities for women will continue to evolve. You don't go from 0 to 60. You go from 0 to 10 and 10 to 20. And if you look at the trajectory of our popularity, I think it's this trajectory and the spike is probably steeper than the men's when it comes to attendance and attendance ratings. And I was at the women's basketball game a week ago, and they hosted Michigan State. They had 11,000 people. It takes time. It doesn't happen overnight. I think we've shown that women are a very viable option on college campuses to bring in revenue, to bring in TV and all the things that athletic directors like. But I don't think it's fair to just compare us immediately with the men and say we should be equal with them at this point in that area. We're team 43. This is the 43rd Michigan softball team. This is baseball's, I believe they're getting close to 160. They're like 158, 159. They've been in existence quite a bit longer than we have. They've had 160 years of tradition behind them.
Do your players still come to you and say, hey, coach, I'm interested in coaching myself?
Absolutely.
What do you tell them?
I tell them it's the it's the greatest thing you can ever do is, my mom always told me that I never left college. She goes, you know, you never left college. I said, why would you? Being in college is the greatest experience of your life. And getting a chance to work with young women who, it's a perfect age group to work with because you're helping mold them into, you know, women. Strong, powerful women is ultimately what we're trying to create, is recognizing that how strong you are and how much you can offer to the world. And so the chance to be that person is why I went into coaching, because the strong women that influenced me, I got to play for two really strong women coaches back in the day, and they impacted me for life, and it's why I chose what I chose. So I'm always excited and do what I can to help them get started, which is put their name out there to colleagues who need volunteers or need graduate assistance and try to help them land. And we have a number of young coaches, and not so young. The head coach at Harvard and the winningest coach in the Ivy League is Jenny Allard, who was one of our first All-Americans. And Kelly Kovac-Shanley is the head coach at Ohio State. Has done a fantastic job there. And even though she's at Ohio State, you know, really proud of those kids who've grown into really strong women themselves. And they're great role models and mentors for a lot of young women.
The diaspora is real. Coach Hutchins, thank you for your service and for your time today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Carol Hutchins is head coach for the University of Michigan softball team and the winningest coach in NCAA softball history. Her recent New York Times op-ed is titled, "Where Are All the Women Coaches?"